new staff member about to continue the presentation.
So would you like me to start?
Yes.
Okay. Good afternoon. Hope everyone had a nice lunch. My name is Tamara Presser, and I'm a staff member in the Stormwater Group at the Central Coast Water Board. And I'm going to go through what's new in the revised permit compared to the existing permit. And as a reminder, you can reference the supplemental sheet 1 for a table identifying which permit tasks are new, modified, or existing requirements. Okay. So I'd like to emphasize that the majority of the revised permit requirements are similar to the existing permit requirements. Some examples of permit components in which we've made some modifications, but the level of effort should be similar to the past, include the illicit discharge and detection requirements, commercial and industrial, and construction site management. Many of the modifications to the existing permit are to help the city focus their resources where they will be most effective in protecting water quality, and in many cases, will not require additional resources to implement. We need to revise the permit to protect water quality. And the majority of the new requirements are adapted from other Phase 1 permits in the state of California. Therefore, they may be new requirements to Salinas, but they are not new relative to other Phase 1 permits. Most of the new requirements that are not adapted from other Phase 1 permits are in the effectiveness and watershed characterization sections that John talked about earlier today. So for the purposes of this presentation, I'm going to go through the substantial new and modified requirements and not focus on the requirements that are the same or slightly modified from the existing permit. So a significant shift we've made in this permit is to take a watershed approach to stormwater management. By requiring the city to conduct watershed characterization and assess the effectiveness of their program using more useful tools. The watershed approach addresses maintenance and restoration of watershed processes. And I'm going to go through the watershed processes impacted by stormwater management that are necessary to protect water quality and beneficial uses in which this permit addresses. So first, surface runoff, which is the movement of runoff on the surface of a landscape. Second, groundwater recharge and discharge, which is the infiltration of runoff to support base flow and groundwater supply. Next, sediment processes, which is the conveyance of sediment. Fourth, chemical processes, which is the ability of a landscape to hold stormwater and thereby prevent pollutants in stormwater from entering receiving waters. And then lastly, evapotranspiration, which is the return of water to the atmosphere. So this graphic shows how rainfall reacts differently when it hits an urbanized or rural landscape compared to a natural landscape. And so you have the urban and rural landscapes on the left and then the natural landscape on the right. And the magnitude of the arrows illustrates that more rainfall in the natural landscape infiltrates into the ground compared to the urban scenario where more of the rainfall is running off along the surface. Altering watershed processes can result in impacts to beneficial uses downstream. And so for this example, in the urban setting, because less rainwater is infiltrating into the ground, less water will be delivered to surface water features over a longer duration. So aquatic habitat is going to receive a quicker flash of water when it rains, but will not receive a sustained supply. The permit includes revised requirements for new and redevelopment to ensure that future development is done in a way that mitigates for these impacts to watershed processes. At the parcel scale, the permit includes requirements to bring the city into alignment with other Phase 1 municipalities. So for the short term, the city is required to continue applying its existing stormwater development standards, and we've just lowered the threshold for the the types of projects that need to adhere to these requirements. And then for the long term, the permit includes revised treatment requirements, and the permit also requires the city to adopt the criteria produced by the Central Coast Joint Effort for Hydromodification Control. And the Central Coast Joint Effort for Hydromodification Control is a process that our board established for all municipalities in our region enrolled in a stormwater permit. And it includes a panel of experts that is helping all the Central Coast municipalities to develop revised numeric criteria for maintaining and restoring watershed processes. And these criteria will be based on local landscape characteristics. The permit also includes requirements to apply low-impact development principles to specific plans in order to address water quality in the development process. These requirements will apply to areas in the future growth area that don't yet have approved specific plans. We really focused on addressing known water quality issues specific to the city of Salinas in this permit. This is a photo that our monitoring staff took, which shows a turbid discharge from the city's storm drain outfall entering the Salinas River. So you can see this is the discharge from the storm from the city's outfall, and then here is the Salinas River.
Excuse me, can you go back to that photo?
Yeah.
It almost looks to me that the Salinas River is more turbid than the discharge, but maybe it's the reverse. Can you interpret the photo?
Can you
jump in, or
are you familiar with this photo?
Okay.
Karen Worcester, I manage our monitoring program. The Salinas River looks somewhat turbid, I think, but that's partly because it's a sand bottom in that area. But you can see the demarcation of this, that line right there is where the turbid plume is entering.
So that photo is a correct interpretation, is that the discharge is more turbid than what it's what the river that is joining.
Right, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
So some examples of requirements in the permit that address known water quality problems specific to Salinas include reduce dirt tracking, develop a plan to decrease pollutants discharged from the stormwater outfall to the Salinas River, reduce trash discharges, and the trash requirements are consistent with the West Coast Governor's Agreement on Ocean Health, and also to comply with approved total maximum daily loads to address impairments. So as John talked about earlier, we've improved the effectiveness assessment requirements to produce more valuable results more quickly without a large increase in effort. This will allow the city to make program improvements that achieve water quality and beneficial use improvements more quickly. We've incorporated the following elements in the permit to inform program effectiveness. First, quantitative measures. An example of a quantitative measure is assessing the depth of debris in catch basins so the dirtiest catch basins are cleaned more frequently. Second, action levels. The permit requires the city to apply stormwater discharge action levels for some pollutants in a few representative portions of the smaller subwatersheds. The permit includes action levels for 5 common urban pollutants and trash. And then third, water quality monitoring. The permit requires the city to monitor stormwater discharge water quality to understand stormwater discharge water quality trends. And then it also requires the city to monitor receiving water at one location to understand receiving water quality trends versus the existing permit, which required receiving water monitoring at multiple locations. One of the changes you will see in many components of the permit is prioritization. We put careful thought into developing ways in the permit in which the city can utilize its resources most efficiently. Prioritization shows up throughout the permit to enable the city to achieve better results with similar level of effort. For example, we have the city prioritize its inspections so city staff can visit higher-risk sites more often and lower-risk sites less often. An example of a higher-risk site might be an industrial facility with a history of noncompliance. So this will result in actions that are more protective of water quality without increasing the number of inspections the city needs to perform. We also have the city prioritize its street sweeping to maximize efficiency without increasing the total number of street miles swept. So those are the main new and revised requirements in the permit. I'm now going to turn it back over to Jennifer Epp, and she is going to explain the key comments on the permit and how we responded to those comments.
Thanks, Jennifer Epp, once again. So we issued a draft permit in September to the public. And in response to that draft permit, we received comments from the city as well as 11 other stakeholders. Water Board staff performed a detailed review of every comment that we received. And as a result, we made significant changes to the draft permit. We also provided a response to every comment we received and answered any questions that people asked during in the comments. You'll find all of the comments as well as our responses in attachment 2 of your agenda package. And we've also included in there a summary of the key comments and an explanation. Many of the comments were based on misinterpretations of the draft permit or incomplete knowledge of what the city's existing permit already had requirements to do. Many of the comments provided good suggestions for improvements of the permit, and we used those good suggestions in our revising of the draft permit. Next, I'll provide some more detail on some of the comments we received and the resulting changes that we made as a result of those comments. US EPA, which you asked about before, provided support for the permit in their comment letter to us. They supported both the permit provisions as well as the approach that we took in writing the permit. A couple of examples of that support from EPA is provided on these next couple of slides. EPA states, "The draft permit incorporates federal stormwater requirements that are consistent with the maximum extent practical standard and federal regulations." EPA also says support of the development requirements. They state, "We are pleased to see the draft permit includes quantitative requirements for stormwater management using low-impact development techniques, which are comparable to other recent municipal stormwater permits in California." The city provided comments saying that the permit was too specific, and the city also provided comments that the permit was not specific enough. To respond to these comments, we modified many of the requirements. In some areas, we provided the city flexibility in how they would achieve the requirement. And we also clarified language in order to reduce the potential for misinterpretation. The city has indicated that the permit still isn't specific enough. However, this is somewhat the nature of stormwater permits. As we've been talking about a lot today, the MEP, maximum extent practical standard, inevitably ends up with a permit that has some amount of specificity and some amount of flexibility. And we feel that we've achieved the right balance between that flexibility and clear and specific requirements. The city also commented that the permit asked them to do too much too soon. In response to that, we moved a lot of the deadlines in the permit back. And a lot of those deadlines extensions that we provided were a year or more into the future. So many of the requirements in the permit, the city doesn't have a deadline for those until 2 years or more from now. City residents commented on the residential runoff provisions. And as a response to that, we removed the prohibition of residential car washing, as well as landscape irrigation water from entering the storm drain system. The city also provided comments on the monitoring program, and as a result, we reduced the number of sample events and modified some of the action levels. And we did this without compromising the information that that monitoring data is going to tell us. The city commented on being held responsible for upstream pollutants as well as agricultural discharges. And in response, we clarified what is covered by the permit and what isn't. And we also clarified what the city's responsibilities are. The permit doesn't apply to agricultural stormwater or agricultural return flows, and the permit specifically states that. And the city is also not responsible for upstream discharges into receiving waters. Additional changes that we made throughout the draft permit included eliminating some of the requirements, significantly modifying requirements in order to assist the city's implementation of those requirements, and simplifying requirements.
Excuse me, Jennifer.
Mm-hmm.
Do you want questions now, or do you want to finish and then have questions?
Either way will work. What I have left to talk about in terms of comments is some of the things that we didn't change. If you have specifics about the topics that we've just talked about, we can hit those, or...
Is it okay, Chair, if we go back one slide?
Okay, certainly.
Under the clarified city's responsibilities, agriculture and upstream discharges, these are discharges that are coming into the city.
Yeah. Right?
And agricultural impacts in the discharges coming into the city.
Correct. Or, the permit has specific language saying this permit does not cover agricultural stormwater or agricultural return flows. So that's even happening inside the city, because there is farming in the Carr Lake area that's inside the permit coverage area. Those activities there are also not covered by this permit.
Okay. So I'm a little confused, and because I'm pretty sure I read in the ag order that the city is responsible to the degree that it has the discretion to do its to pass along its own requirements, for instance, to the ag operations within the city, so that if they're flowing effluents into city-controlled stormwater facilities, then it becomes the city's responsibility. So, can you straighten me out by telling me what are the city's responsibilities in the ag order relative to non-city discharges coming in and non-city discharges that are within the city's stormwater perimeter?
Okay, and so you're asking a question about what's in the ag order or what's in this permit?
What's in this permit?
Okay, because your question, you said the ag, what the requirements in the ag order a couple times.
The ag order that's proposed, the draft ag order that we have. I'm sorry, the proposed MS4 permit that we have here.
Okay.
What are, in this, what are the city's responsibilities relative to agricultural input inside the city and coming into the city?
Okay, so any agricultural activity, so when we're talking about agricultural return flows or agricultural stormwater, the city is not responsible for that, whether or not it enters their system or doesn't enter their system. So, and the permit explicitly says that.
Okay. The reason I'm confused is because the city is responsible for the receiving water quality. And so
the city is responsible for their contributions to the receiving water quality.
Right.
If the pollutant... Let me see if I can explain this. So the city is responsible for their contributions to what's in those receiving waters. But the city is not responsible for the agricultural return flows or the agricultural stormwater. Mm-hmm. For the most part, agricultural water does not enter the city's MS4. There are exceptions. For the most part, the majority of the, and I'm saying MS4, which is an acronym, the city's storm drain system, for the most part, those enter the reclamation canal directly and don't enter the city system. The city does indicate that during some, you know, rain events and stuff, there could be some stuff from a flow that ends up entering in the storm into their storm drain system. And so if there is a pollution that is occurring because of that, the city's not held responsible if it's if it comes from the agricultural return flows or agricultural stormwater. What they are responsible for is things like the dirt tracking onto the street, and they are responsible for this outfall. So the outfall is a city storm drain pipe that carries storm water, and therefore they are responsible for that. And it looks like Phil wants to jump in and add some things here.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that the reason for that is that agricultural return flows and agricultural stormwater are exempt from the Clean Water Act and NPDES permitting. And so for that, that's why we've exempted those discharges from this NPDES permit.
But there were a couple of exceptions. So
correct, because the ag discharges that are not return flows or stormwater don't receive that exemption, and so they are covered under this permit.
Right. So from a city's perspective, if ag operations track dirt onto city roads that put sediments into the storm system,
it is covered by this permit.
The city is dinged for it, essentially.
The city is responsible for putting requirements in place to manage that, yes.
Right. So it puts the city in the position of basically regulating ag operations which track dirt into the city.
Yeah, and that's very similar to what they have to do for construction sites.
Okay.
So, and currently the city is not doing that. So currently right now when we go and we did an inspection, you've got this construction site next to this agricultural operation. Construction site, they've got all their BMPs in place, they got their rock, all their trucks are clean, and then right next door, somebody's tracking all this mud onto the city street, and the city currently is saying, oh, that's ag, I can't do anything about that. Well, we're making it clear in this permit that they can and they should be doing something about that.
Okay, so in that case, the city is responsible for agricultural.
It's not return flows or stormwater. They're responsible for the tracking of the dirt onto the street,
and then,
or at least handling that issue.
All right. In the case of Natividad Creek, is it true that there's a mixing, where there's some city runoff into Natividad Creek, and then there's some ag runoff into Natividad Creek as it runs through the city of Salinas?
The majority of the water bodies have both influences in them, yes.
Okay.
And I don't know specifically for that creek, but I can't imagine that there isn't in that one.
So in cases where there's mixing and the city is responsible for the outflow into receiving waters, how is the city relieved of responsibility from non-city input, such as ag input, to that mix?
By the language in the permit. The language in the permit talks about the city being responsible for its discharges and how those discharges are contributing to the problem. So if a receiving water body is polluted and has high level of pollutants, the city isn't responsible for all those pollutants. They're responsible for what they're contributing to it.
So to know who's contributing what, do we rely on the sampling program?
Yeah, and we've carefully thought about that in the monitoring program, and we will. Are we talking about the monitoring program, or did we already talk about it? Well, and we can give you more details if you want to know some specifics about the monitoring, but we did specifically look at that issue and try to make sure that we can answer the right questions for the permit.
Okay.
Do you want us to?
Not yet. I'm guessing from the record that when the city reps speak, they might talk about responsibilities they think that they have that are out of their control due to it not being them as the source. But maybe if we get to that then.
Okay.
All right. Thank you.
Great. Does that help? Okay. Excellent. So we talked about that one. Okay. So let me just get back to the right spot. Okay. So there were some comments where we did not follow the city's recommendations. So several of those comments are in relating to low impact development for parking lots, infill, and the type of soils there is in the city. So I'll go through each of these one by one. Starting with parking lots. The city believes that low impact development features are not appropriate for parking lots in the city. However, parking lots typically produce large amounts of runoff that contains pollutants. Parking lots tend to be dirty and they have a lot of runoff. And we find that low-impact development is the most effective way of mitigating that issue.
Jennifer, why did the city say it doesn't feel it's appropriate?
Due to the city's soils aren't as permeable as there are in some other areas, and so they think that it'll cause that because of that it's not appropriate. And so we've looked at that information, and we do find that in most situations, Salinas can use low-impact development strategies in parking lots if they're designed appropriately. So we do think it is feasible. The city has another concern about parking lots, and their concern that if parking lot reconstruction triggers low-impact development requirements, then that'll discourage people from doing parking lot maintenance. However, to trigger the requirements, someone has to remove all of the pavement and all of the subbase in a parking lot the size bigger than a basketball court. So we're not talking pothole repair here. We're not talking just your everyday resurfacing. We're talking about removing all of the pavement and the subbase on an area greater than a basketball court in order to trigger the requirements to do something. This type of reconstruction doesn't happen that often, and we feel that when it does, it's an opportunity to improve the impacts that that lot has on water quality. And so it triggers the need to implement some of the requirements. And our requirements for parking lots are consistent with other current Phase 1 permits. We're not just picking on the city. The city also commented that low-impact development requirements will discourage infill. And we agree that there are benefits, many benefits, of infill and redevelopment-type projects. And we don't find that these requirements will discourage infill. The requirements are consistent with other current Phase 1 municipalities in California. As well, the joint effort that Tamara talked about will treat infill and redevelopment separately in developing the criteria. And in addition, the permit includes alternative compliance options for locations where on-site compliance isn't feasible. The city has also been saying for many years that they have clay soils. Therefore, they can't infiltrate, and therefore, they can't do low-impact development. The city provided us soil data for their future growth area. We reviewed that soils data, and we found that they should be able to infiltrate the smaller storms in most areas.
Does the city have a staff geologist?
I don't believe so. I believe the report was written by a consultant.
Okay.
But I think the consultant might be here.
Have you discussed that conclusion with their consultant or their engineer?
We have not. We got that soils information fairly recently, and so we've run the numbers fairly recently. But I'm sure it's a discussion we'll be having.
Okay. And Mr. Johnston has a question for you.
Yeah, I'm seeing in a letter from the Public Works Director that was in the supplement that, and I assume it bears on this stuff, something about creating or replacing impervious surfaces and or turf. What's the turf question?
Tamara, do you want to hit that?
And that's the January 25th letter from Gary Peterson.
And I guess, Michael, what is your question? Your question is issue is, or what do we mean by turf?
What do we mean by turf? I understand the logic of saying a trigger point to low impact development standards is creating or replacing impervious surfaces, but why are we applying that to turf too?
Okay. Gotcha. I think we understand the question.
Okay. So the turf portion of it is part of the applicability thresholds for the treatment requirements, and the reason we included turf is that turf acts similarly to an impervious surface. So when you put turf on a landscape, you typically compact the soil underneath it, so you lose some of the perviousness of the topsoil. And then to maintain turf, you typically maintain a fairly saturated condition. And then also turf typically is there's a high amount of nutrients on turf, and so those nutrients are then carried off. And it is looked at as a significant land use in an urban setting.
Well, what is turf? Is it grass? Is
it's,
it
yeah, wood, lawn.
Wood?
Lawn. And I think turf is a typical term used in, I guess, when you're designing a site or something, you reference lawn.
Landscapers use the term turf.
Correct. Hmm. And because of the thresholds, the thresholds are at the size of a basketball court. And so this isn't going to be applied at a small residential scale. It's going to be when you're putting in a large turf area in a park-like setting or a municipal setting.
I'm a Ram fan, and in 1999, when they won the Super Bowl, they were the greatest show on turf.
So just to understand, then, if somebody's replacing the grass on a football field, for example, which is more than a basketball court, would trigger that. What would the low-impact development requirements that are being proposed, what impact would they have, then, on that project?
So that type of project would have to retain the water quality storm event, which in the city of Salinas is 0.6 inches on site. And if they couldn't do that, then they could explore other means of treating that water.
As a practical matter, what does that mean? Does a football field retain 0.6 inches? Or I'm assuming it doesn't, because you're putting it in as a trigger. So what would they have to do to replace that turf?
So for the portion of that volume of water that isn't naturally retained on that football field, you then would need to, so for the football field situation, you wouldn't want to put best management practices right in the middle of the field. So most likely somewhere around the perimeter before that runoff has the ability to discharge to the city's storm sewer system, you'd have to put some measures in place to basically slow that flow and capture it and treat it and soak it into the ground.
Does that help, Michael?
I understand better.
Okay.
So I just want to make one thing clear. Under the Clean Water Act, the city or any permittee is supposed to eliminate all sources of non-stormwater discharges, which includes discharges off of a turf. And so if it is a significant source of pollutants, then there do need to be BMPs that are done to help eliminate or prevent that discharge. And so that's one of the reasons why they're adding turf or requiring LAD measures on turf.
And when she says BMPs, we don't mean the same acronym that the last presentation used. So this is best management practices. I think they were using it for something else. Basin management plan.
Yeah. Sure. Dr. Hunter.
Okay, so help me out, because I thought grass, a grassy area, would be
desirable.
Desirable. And so Jessica raised the issue of chemicals that may be on the grass that could be part of the runoff. But why wouldn't a grassy area be considered permeable? Or is it just the clay soils of the Salinas nature of those areas in the watershed?
So typically a conventional grass turf area doesn't act the same as a what you would think of as a natural grassy pasture
field, like
or
a field.
Because this area has been altered in order to install that landscape feature.
So it's in between a parking lot and a natural field. It's somewhere in the middle. Right, Tamara?
Correct.
But what I guess what I'm asking is the infiltration rate is affected in a grassy planted area.
Yeah.
Such right. as a lawn. But if you are
such
talking
a
about
lawn.
Say a grass swale that was designed to accept mm-hmm. stormwater, mm-hmm. that would most likely, if it was designed correctly, be designed differently than a football field. Mm-hmm. Typically, you actually take out the some of the native soil and replace it with amended soils that mm-hmm. has the ability to accept more rainwater.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And the permit, just to clarify, doesn't actually say basketball court. It has a number, but I'm just trying to put the size into perspective because it's hard to visualize what, 5,000 square feet is. At least it is for me. So if we have basketball fans, you can appreciate that.
Sure. If I may.
Mr. Jeffries.
Yeah, I kind of disagree with some of the interpretations you have with turf and soil because I do that type of work. And in the Salinas area especially, since we do have a lot of clay in the soils, you have to remove that and put in soils that will percolate. Now, the city of Salinas instituted 20 years ago, because I was on the city council at that time, Zeroscape in our new development. For some of the same reasons is to reduce the amount of water that we would use because of the water issue, but also for stormwater runoff. When you have Zeroscape, it's somewhat like a low-impact development type of a development of the landscape. Did you consider the Salinas Zeroscape? Did their staff bring up their development standards?
Well, as far as the issue of the turf being somewhat permeable and potentially holding the water, the requirement has you do the calculation to retain a certain size storm. And so based on your condition, if you have enough capacity in the turf, Tammy, correct me if I'm wrong, then you wouldn't have to do anything else. So if you're getting nice permeability, it's not running off, then you're good. You don't have to do anything. You just have to do the calculation. But if your ground is compacted enough and it is a scenario where you're not retaining that storm and it's running off, then you treat that portion that's running off. As far as the Zeroscape question, I'm not quite sure I understand. If someone's putting in a Zeroscape instead of a lawn, then they're not putting in turf, and so this wouldn't be triggered.
I'm not a geologist, but I can tell you that you can dig anywhere in this city, and you go down anywhere from 18 to 24 inches, you're going to hit clay. And that's the reason, I don't want to get into ag waivers, but that's the reason the west of Salinas, that you, in the agriculture fields, that you have tiling, is because there's no percolation in those particular areas. So I can guarantee you that any place you go in the city of Salinas, and even in the future development area, you can go down 18 to 20 inches, 24 inches, and you're going to hit a clay layer, and you can't go any further. And you can put water in there, and it'll be there a week later because it just doesn't percolate through that clay layer.
Yeah, and what these requirements are is they're looking at the smaller storms. So the smaller storms are the ones that tend to contain the most contaminants, not the huge storms. It's those small, frequent ones. And so the requirements have you retain that smaller storms. And like I said, we looked at the numbers in the future growth area, and for most of the places, they can infiltrate that within the three-day
period. Well, you can within the 18 to 24-inch area, but once that is saturated, it has no place else to go. It has to run off. I mean, the ground just won't take anymore. So that's one of the issues that this city has to face. And you have a lot of folks that have put out a lot of money on development and redevelopment, or anticipating on doing that, and they've calculated their return on their dollar on what was before them. Now, I think some of the concern is with the change of the order that their development is going to be prohibited because they won't be able to meet all the requirements in the new order. So have you looked at that? And I'm looking at economics of the whole issue.
And cost is one of the things I'm going to get to in a minute. So why don't we hold cost questions until
I'll just hold off the cost question. My next question is, reading in here, school districts. Now, I'm interpreting that you're making the city be the required to take care of the school districts as well? Is that
no, the city doesn't have the authority to do that. And
well, that's what I was going to tell you. They don't have the authority if that's a requirement.
They go through the Division of State Architects and not through the city planning process. So, no, we don't require. So the same thing would be for a federal facility if the feds build a piece of land. So, no, the permit does not require them to take responsibility for those type of properties.
Then that leads to my next question. You talked about turf areas. The largest turf areas other than city parks are schools. So how does these permits integrate into the school districts, or do they?
Well, the areas that aren't covered by municipal stormwater permit projects that trigger the construction general permit, so those are projects that disturb an acre or more of area, those are all covered by the statewide general permit that does have some requirements for this post-development scenario. And that basically permit kind of picks up all the, you could say, holes in legislation or in regulation and therefore has some requirements that all projects in the state would have to do if they're not being covered by another municipal permit.
Okay.
And those are fairly new. The post-construction requirements are just now going into effect this coming September for projects. It's been a permit that was adopted a while back, and there was a phase-in process for that.
Okay.
Mr. Delgado.
Thank you. So, Jennifer, are you saying that post-construction requirements on schools are at state, these are state requirements, those would be the mechanism through which the city would not be accountable for runoff coming off of school turf or school impervious surfaces? Because if that runoff does go into the storm system, it seems that perhaps the city would be accountable by the sampling and measuring programs.
I guess it depends on what you mean by accountable. So the city...
Well, they would essentially get dinged, that once the school drains into the storm system and the city's on the hook for their storm system, the city would logically think they were being held accountable for the school runoff.
Yeah, so the city can't, see if Phil's looking at me, make sure I get this right. The city can't passively receive pollutants from somebody else. So if you have a school site that is dumping oil down their drain and it's going into the city's system, the city can't say, not my problem, it's a school and I can't do anything. The city needs to use the mechanisms that it has to take care of that. And that could be a variety of things. The city could treat the stuff that's coming into their system. They could try to figure out a way to stop the pollution from happening. When we're talking about the permit not applying to schools and federal facilities, we're talking about the post-construction aspects, because those projects, when they're developed, don't go through the city planning process, and so they won't trigger the city's low-impact development requirements.
So my logical follow-up question is, how can we expect the city to keep track of federal, school, and other properties when they're pretty full-on busy trying to keep track of themselves?
Well, in general, in the city's illicit discharge detection elimination program, the city is to look for problems. So they're to go around and take dry weather samples, which aren't stormwater because it's dry weather, so it's coming from somewhere, and see in a test, you know, a field kit, if there's high hits of something. And if there is high hits of things, then the city needs to figure out what's causing that problem. And it could be a variety of sources. It could be an industrial facility. It could be a school. And so depending on what it is, the city is to look to figure out how they can best address the issue. So it's not like they're going to go around and look at schools, or they're going to go around. I mean, they're going to look at the problems and then figure out how to solve them.
So if there's a problem, they are accountable to find out where it's coming from. So to the extent that non-city property owners, non-city regulated property owners are causing issues, it's on the city's dime to find the issues and address the issues.
Well, and a lot of times we work cooperatively with them. I mean, there's been instances in the past, you know, there's the infamous broccoli incident in the city of Salinas where our monitoring staff saw broccoli coming out of the storm drain, and it conveniently had the tag from the company that it came from, and so they were able to figure out where, and so we worked cooperatively with the city and in order to address that issue and to figure out how to have the operation change things to prevent that discharge from going into the storm drain and have it go to the correct place. So when these issues come up that are a challenge for the city, especially if they're big issues, oftentimes we work together.
Okay. And my original question was on the paragraph at the bottom of page 2 of the 3-page January 25th city letter comments, and it was regarding turf and impervious surfaces. And the city's contention is that it used to be that new developments and redevelopment projects on this matter were evaluated according to their net impact. So if I redevelop an old lot and there's less runoff than there used to be, then I've done enough. But the city is asserting that the trigger point has changed,
mm-hmm.
and now it's only if I am creating or replacing an impervious turf or hardscape, then I've got to do some things, and that would take away one of the incentives by increasing one of the costs to redevelopment areas that right now the redevelopment areas have an advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So what's
and the reason why we changed that requirement was to bring the city up to speed with what other current phase one permits are doing. The city, that requirement that they currently have, it lags behind other permits.
Okay, so in other words, we're saying regardless of whether or not it shifts the incentive from redevelopment to development, we're doing this change to be consistent with other phase one permittees.
Yeah, and we have looked, and we don't think, when you look at projects, it's not doing this or not doing this that is the tipping point for infill projects. I mean, infill projects deal with a whole host of things, and this is one small piece of that.
Thank you.
Okay. Dr. Hunter?
Thank you. Just to go back to the example of or the idea of the school or the federal facility,
mm-hmm.
and dry sampling. So if the city were to determine that a school is the source of a particular pollutant, and so how does that factor into the monitoring report, and how does that then separate out in the larger structure of the permit the influence of the school and what they're actually, you know, what that downstream receiving water is showing? Is there a way for them to say, well, 20% of this particular pollutant is coming off federal facilities and schools? We know this because we have dry sampling that indicates those are the specific pollutants coming off schools and federal facilities. I mean, is that how that works?
Well, I don't know if you'd look at it that specifically. I mean, monitoring data in general will have spikes that occur because of a particular event. You know, there was a fire here recently. When the fire department put it out, the runoff from the fire was this bright green stuff. And so if you take monitoring samples in that time period, you're going to see some spikes. And so monitoring data in general has things that change it, and when one analyzes the data, they would take those things into consideration and say, oh, that's a spike from that event, and so you'd look at the remainder of the data.
So I get that, but I guess the school is not going to be a spike. It's there all the time, as is a federal facility. And so if you're dry sampling, how often does dry sampling occur?
I think it is quarterly. I'd have
quarterly.
To check.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, but in general, so there, you know, as far as how you assess how a stormwater permit's doing, the monitoring data is one piece of that. It's not the only piece of that. And as we've talked about the maximum extent practical standard, one of the main things that the city is judged on is how well it's doing the things the best to their ability. So are they just saying, oh, well, we know that's what the problem is and we didn't even talk to them? Or are they being diligent? Are they working with us? Are they working with the school districts? You know, so as far as what the city is being graded on, monitoring is just one piece of the puzzle.
Okay.
So we'd be looking at, is the city implementing things to their ability? There's certain things that they can't do. There's certain things that they can, but are they trying? Are they doing the maximum extent practicable with their limitations?
Mm-hmm. Okay. So the monitoring, I mean, I'm looking at it in terms of if I'm trying to identify sources of problems that are showing up in receiving water within the city, then I'm going to use that monitoring data to tell me, as you pointed out in this diagram, that, you know, there's certain places where there's hot spots going on, and that's how I'm going to know where to implement my best practices. And so that's where I was trying to see how monitoring could identify both places where the city is responsible as well as places where the city really doesn't have jurisdiction and doesn't have authority to change the way that property is managed or designed for runoff. So that's what I'm trying to understand.
Yeah, and yeah. I think that that's true in that there's one aspect of the stormwater monitoring for dry weather where they compare the results to action levels, and the action levels signify basically an elevated condition of pollution, pretty bad water quality. And so when that occurs, the city is required to do something to fix the problem. And if they were to go forth into that sub-watershed and find that it was a federal or school facility that was the problem, you know, they can't completely absolve themselves of any responsibility, but they're not the primary responsibility. The primary responsibility lies with that school facility. And the school facility or the federal facility will have a phase two stormwater permit with us in the next few years once that permit gets adopted. And so they'll have their responsibilities, and that's who would be the primary party responsible.
Go ahead.
I have my own opinion about the answer, but the question I want to ask you is, does staff believe that it's an easy answer or a very difficult answer to find out within a sub-watershed when monitoring shows a problem where that problem is particularly coming from?
I think it's mixed. I think some issues are very easy to trace and some issues are very difficult to trace. And through the program, the city should be going after where they find issues. And in some areas, they're going to be able to resolve that very easily. In other areas, they are not.
Yeah. And to be clear, the idea of the action levels is for the city to identify problem areas and work to fix them. It's not to that they have to absolutely correct the problem overnight. We understand it's a process.
Thank you. But what they can't do is just say, oh, well, we're not going to do anything. So we look a lot about when we review compliance and we review reports of all of our municipalities, we look at, well, what has the city tried to do? They tried this didn't work, they tried this didn't work, versus, well, we know there's a problem and we just didn't do anything.
Dr. Okay. Wolf.
Mr. Chair.
Yes.
I realize, you know, the challenges in terms of addressing, you know, the technicalities of enforcing and putting into place this phase one. But I was curious about, okay, we're, you know, Salinas is not the very first city in California, so just went online and Googled, and there are about 80 to 100 cities in California with 100,000 people or more, which therefore I would assume we have 80 to 100 phase one permits in place. So we're not breaking new grounds, maybe for the city here, but not for the state of California. So perhaps some of these questions and concerns, and in some case my colleagues, I think, infer to unintended consequences. Other cities must have gone through that. You know, I'm listening about the school issue. Well, every city has schools, so you know, how they must have dealt with that somehow.
Mm-hmm.
So perhaps looking at the experience of the past, and I think that was one of the very first question that you ask, you know, how did other cities respond? But we basically have 80 to 100 cities in California that probably, you know, have gone through this process.
Yeah, and there's a couple ways that the city can help use that information and learn from each other. Sometimes we're able to point cities to other good examples, like, hey, you know, talk to the folks down in this municipality. They're doing, we know they have a good program for this. That happens, as well as there's CASQA, which is an organization where municipalities can share knowledge and best practices with each other. And so that's a very active group throughout California where one city that's figured out how to do something can share that information with somebody else. And so you're right. There's a lot of things that are being done in different areas, and every city has things they do better than others. And so if people can learn from each other, figure out how did you do that and have it work and not be too big of a deal, then they can share that.
Okay.
Okay.
How much more with your presentation?
I'm going to go over, I think we're going to get to, we're going to get to cost and time, so a couple big ones here.
Okay.
So, and I am the last one, so. Okay. So one of the other main comments was the city recommended that we continue to postpone the adoption of this permit. So I'll talk about that a little bit. We have already worked very extensively with the city, and we've repeatedly provided them with additional time throughout this process. We did this before drafting the permit. We then, when we gave them permit, we doubled the review time that they had on the draft permit. We added a third public workshop to the process, and we also delayed the hearing. It was originally scheduled for December, and we moved it until today in order to provide the city with more time. And then just as recently as last month, we provided the agenda package a week early to the city in order to provide them with as much time as possible to prepare for the hearing today.
But they specifically took issue with that as not being early enough.
Correct.
In this letter, the January 25th letter.
Correct.
Okay.
We also moved the hearing to Salinas in order to accommodate city residents that wanted to attend. We've really assisted the city every step of the way through this process in order to help them understand the permit and digest the information that they had. Prior to drafting the permit, we met with them and we explained the issues that we wanted to address in the draft permit and asked for their input. We followed that up with several phone conversations. We also met with them before the draft permit was released, and we went through the permit to explain it to them. And then we provided an opportunity weekly for them to call and talk to us and ask questions. And as we got through, continued through the comment period, we offered additional call times to continue to have more dialogue with them.
Well, did you in fact have contact time with them? I mean, you're saying you offered or made the opportunity.
We did. They didn't take us up on all the opportunities, but they took us up on several.
Okay.
And so we did have several of the weekly calls, and then toward the end of the process, we had a few additional calls. Most recently, in December, what we did is we had a very lengthy phone call with them. I think we spent four hours on the phone going through the information that we're talking about today. So we had taken their comments and made changes to the permit, and so we walked them through what those changes to the permit would be so that when they got the agenda package today, there wouldn't be big surprises, that they knew what to expect, what we had changed in the permit as a result of their comments. And we believe that continuing to postpone the permit won't result in a better permit. The remaining concerns that the city has are for issues that we've discussed with them several times already. And we feel that we understand those issues, and we've made all the appropriate changes to the permit. And we don't think that having those same discussions again will improve the permit. We will continue to work with the city in compliance assistance in them implementing the permit. But we believe it's time to shift both our resources as well as the city's resources in actually implementing this permit and the compliance assistance that we can provide through that process. The city's current permit expired 2 years ago, and continuing to postpone the permit poses a risk to water quality that outweighs the benefits. That risk includes irreversible development that can be implemented, as well as ongoing degradation of water quality in Salinas. Moving on to cost. Like all cities, Salinas is concerned about cost. The city developed some large cost estimates, and most of the city's estimate were based on things that either weren't required by the permit, or things that they were already required to do by their existing permit, or things that they would have done anyways if they didn't have a permit. However, we did go back through the permit in order to provide clarifying language in places where it was appropriate. We also explained requirements to the city where it was appropriate. And we did that both verbally in some of our conversations as well as in writing in the comment responses that we did. And for components of the permit where the requirements would have unintentionally really increased the city's level of efforts, we actually modified the draft permit requirements. An example of that is the inspections. We inadvertently were going to, the language would have had them do a lot more inspections of industrial facilities, and they pointed that out, and we made changes to keep the level of inspection similar. And when we think about cost, there's some key things that are important to keep in mind. The regulations require the maximum extent practical to be the standard. The standard doesn't mean that you don't do something because it's expensive. But what you can do is you can implement alternative practices that achieve the same results that are less expensive. So it gives you options to how you comply. And when we made the modifications to the permit, when we developed this draft permit, as we've talked about before, we really looked hard at how we could develop efficiencies for the city. How can we have them prioritize? How can they have them do things that are more effective without it being a lot more work? And we were in many areas successful to do that. We do a lot of prioritization throughout the permit. So they do more in one area and less in another. They achieve better results without more effort. And as you've heard throughout the presentation today, stormwater, clean stormwater, is important. And the cost of not implementing these requirements is significant. It's significant to the local water bodies, the communities, and the Monterey Bay downstream. In your supplemental package, you received some additional comments. And we received 7 letters, including one from the city, on the agenda package. And with the exception of the comments from the US EPA, the comments were similar to comments that we had received previously and responded to in your staff report. Supplemental sheet number 1 corrects a typo in the TMDL section, and supplemental sheet number 2 copies some TMDL section language from the permit provisions, from the permit findings into the permit provisions. And that was made in response to a very recent comment we had from EPA. And they found that it was necessary to do that in order to clarify the TMDL requirement, be consistent with other permits, and to be consistent with the federal regulations. The change in language doesn't change the requirement. It just puts it specifically in the permit, because the permit already told them they had to comply with adopted TMDLs. Okay, so in conclusion, you guys ready for this?
Drum roll.
Dun, 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 dun. Revising the Salinas permit is important for current and future water quality and protecting the beneficial uses of the Central Coast region. This permit is an incremental change from their existing permit, and the city's current permit doesn't meet the maximum extent practical standard, and we need to bring the city up to speed with other Phase 1 permits in the state. The permit is consistent with federal regulations, and we've undergone an extensive process to help the city understand the permit and have made significant changes in response to their comments. Spending additional time will not result in a better permit, and it's important that we don't delay the revision of this permit any longer. We recommend that the board adopts the revised municipal stormwater permit today, including the minor changes found in your supplemental sheets. Thank you for your time, and we'll take any additional questions that you have.
Okay, I've got two questions for you. One is, can a discharger say that they're unable to meet MEP because it's too costly? In other words, what would be the most practical method? The maximum extent practical method is too costly, or that any of the alternative methods are too costly. Is cost a defense?
I can.
Okay, you can or I can. Either one. So
either way, they can't say that they can do nothing because it's too costly.
Okay.
Under MEP, cost is a factor. It's one of basically five that the state board has identified as part of MEP. The biggest is, not economic feasibility, technical feasibility, and then you can look into cost and you can look into public acceptance. But they cannot do nothing, and they if there's a problem, they have to do a sufficient BMP to help correct the problem. And what state board guidance has said is if you are only doing a few BMPs and it is not it is not improving the problem, you're not meeting MEP. If you are doing every BMP that is technically feasible and not cost prohibitive, then you probably are meeting MEP.
Okay. And so maximum extent practicable. They could do something because it's not too expensive, but it may not meet MEP because it's not the maximum extent.
Exactly.
So somehow they've got to figure out which tools to use.
Right. They can. Part of the permit allows them the flexibility to choose different tools to address the problem.
Right. Mm-hmm.
But they have to address the problem.
Right. Okay.
It gives them the flexibility to choose other alternative methodologies to address the issue.
Then my question is in response to Mr. Peterson's letter of January 25th, and he makes some comments here on page 2, top of page 2. He actually starts at the bottom of page 1, and his concern is there's provisions that are vague and subject to various interpretations. Not all the provisions of the revised draft permit are clearly enough written to be implemented with certainty. Doesn't the uncertainty actually give the city flexibility to go ahead and define that the way they would like, and essentially bounce it off staff and say, this is what we're going to do to interpret and implement that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
It's the catch 22 of stormwater regulations.
Right,
in some respects,
right.
If you're specific, you know exactly what to do. But
all right, so it's really a benefit, not a detriment.
That's true.
The way at least staff looks at it.
Definitely. In a lot of places, we have been fairly specific, and in a lot of places, we have given the city flexibility. And there's also a lot of places where we allow the city to propose an alternative methodology that Roger can approved to achieve the same objective. In essence, we're looking to get the job done. How the city does that,
okay,
we're always open to different ways to achieve the objective.
Dr. Wolf.
Yeah, segue to Mr. Chair. question, pardon me, is, you know, the permit is going to be valid for a period of 5 years, if I understand correctly.
Mm-hmm.
Other permittees in the Phase 1 in the state of California, in rolling in the Phase 2 to Phase 1, is there any flexibility to provide a timeline phase-in of various activities, which both are time-based and based on scalability. In other words, instead of once, let's say there is a vote, okay, next month, you know, you're full steam ahead. If there is a way to gradually, and it would be, I would assume, a phasing plan that would have to be provided to the staff and for your approval, that will allow a little bit of us, you know, a softer ramping up and alleviate some of the concerns of having to, in a very relatively short period of time, meet all these requirements.
Yeah, and we think that we did that in the revision that we made for the permit that we have for you today. We moved a lot of deadlines back for the city, even for a lot of things that we thought, well, the city's already doing this, so, you know, but in order to have them, you know, we have some key things that are important to do soon, and some of that is the low-impact development stuff. So they have a fairly short period of time to get some things in place, so those are in place for when development comes through. But for a lot of things in the permit, they don't have to do it for 2, 3, 4 years in order to give this the city the time to get up to speed and make the adjustments. Okay.
Okay. Mr. Johnston.
Thank you. Reading Mr. Peterson's January 25th letter, what I get out of it is three principal arguments for delay, I guess. And the first is that the permit as written is complicated and ambiguous. Mm-hmm. And I understand that staff feels that essentially the ambiguities have been clarified and that what remains are differences of opinion as to what's appropriate.
Mm-hmm.
The second is the question of economic feasibility.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of waiting to hear from the city what they think the costs are now that there's been more discussion. I know there was a comparison between an $80 million and a $100,000 number, and I'm hoping the gap is smaller. And the third one is having to do with the hydro modification. It seems like the staff's main objection to any more time, one is we want to get on with focusing on implementing, and two is, and the one I think is probably more at the heart of it, is we're concerned that if this process goes on further, that there will be development on scale in the future development, future growth area, that will essentially be irreversible in terms
yes.
of the consequences of what's done. Do we have any sense of what's out there and what's proposed in terms of development? I note that it looks to me like a lot of the stuff in terms of low-intensity development is phased in over the next couple of years. It doesn't take effect immediately. Do we have any sense of what... So I understand staff's concern. Do we have any sense of what's out there in terms of proposed development?
Well, we know the first chunk, maybe it's not even the first chunk, but a chunk in the future growth area is in the specific planning phase or has gone past. It was a Lowe's development, but I think it's changed to something else.
Yeah, and I think it's they've approved the specific plan for that area. So it's the northwest corner, small little chunk, and they've already approved the specific plan for that area.
And really the...
And would this draft order affect that plan?
Nope.
Okay, so that's...
Because the specific plan has been approved.
Not on the table.
They have to implement the requirements that are currently on the books for that, but,
right.
but they don't have to do the new ones. And really the as far as when the next project hits, it's anybody's guess. You know, it's going to depend on when the developer's ready to do the project based on their thought that it can move forward successfully.
And in terms of large-scale development, new development, am I correct in my understanding that these requirements don't kick in for 2 years? Looking
I don't
at
think
the
so. There's some things that kick in fairly soon in terms of changing some thresholds. There's some short-term as well as some long-term.
Okay.
There's a very small amount of things they have to do in the short-term. And then in the long term, it's a year or more out, they will do things that will come into alignment with the joint effort and some other things.
And finally, still on the question of large-scale development. Can you explain a little bit what is going on with the? I don't know the acronym. The process involving multiple municipalities to come up with stormwater standards for new development.
You're talking about the joint effort?
I am.
So you want to know the status of where that is in the process?
And,
I can have
Dominic. And whether
Rock.
That will be binding upon Salinas, how that fits in all of this?
Sure. Dominic?
Hi, I'm Dominic Rock. I work with the Water Board. And I've been the lead staff on development and coordination of the joint effort for hydro modification and low impact development. And that's the process you referred to of all the phase two MS4s and the city of Salinas cooperating and collaborating to arrive at a set of requirements for hydro modification and low impact development that is more appropriate to the landscape and to their conditions than what was once contemplated and what is actually being implemented throughout other parts of California, which seems to be rather ineffective in many places. So,
is the scope of that region-wide, county-wide?
It's region-wide, so central
all
coast
the,
region.
All the phase two municipalities.
They're all on
and
board,
Salinas.
And the city of Salinas as well.
Must so, be a big meeting.
Yeah. Well, what we've done is we've actually conducted a process of landscape analysis and full review of all the processes, the watershed processes that that occur throughout our region. We're coming up with a set of watershed management zones, and within each zone we know which management strategies are most appropriate, and ultimately we'll be selecting numeric requirements that are appropriate for dealing with post-construction runoff in each zone. And on March 15th, I'll actually be addressing you with a full review and update on that process and where we are in that process and what will be coming in the next few months. Because in July, at your July meeting, you'll actually be presented with an opportunity to approve of the selected numeric criteria. At that point, the cities have additional time to incorporate those requirements into their ordinances and to adopt and then begin implementing those requirements as part of their normal development review and approval process. So Salinas would take the joint effort findings and numeric requirements, and they would implement those. And those generally are going to be addressing the watershed processes we've talked about, not just the effects of, you know, of urban runoff on stream stability, but also on the effect of recharging aquifers, maintaining aquatic habitat in streams, and stream stability as well. So, have
and
I answered your question?
Is this joint effort, just so I understand the character of it a little better,
yeah.
Is this essentially a process whereby we, the board, our staff, calling in the cities as stakeholders and kind of wrangling a process whereby we get their input and we're writing it? Is this more of a consensus-based process? What's
I can explain.
Are we going to hear from the Salinas and the Phase 2 cities? What are you guys doing?
Yeah, well, what we've done is we've hired consultants and kind of an expert panel. Someone referred to them as an expert panel earlier, but in effect they are the leading scientists in the country on the issue of urban stormwater impacts. And we've asked them to evaluate our region and do a set of analytical work and technical work. And during that process, they've delivered several technical memoranda, and there's a group that I convened called the Joint Effort Review Team, which is predominantly municipality stakeholders. They're the lead stormwater staff from several of our phase two communities. We also have some representation from the environmental community and from the development community as well. But we have essentially a smaller group, functions almost like it's not a technical advisory committee because they aren't offering technical advice. But instead, they're looking at the results of the technical work and asking questions like, is this going to work for us? How did you come up with that answer and that question? And so that process is a I would say it's water board staff-led technical work with stakeholder involvement all the way through. And then during this is a key time, because right now we're really starting to roll out some of these results to the broader community of Phase 2 municipal stakeholders. And I have I've gone to several meetings around the state where a larger group of the urban stormwater dischargers will be assembled, and I explain the joint effort to them. And then in March, we'll have an opportunity to vet that before you, and that will be another opportunity for those stakeholders to come to that meeting and express their feelings about it. Probably even more exciting for them is that on February 15th and 16th, we'll be holding two workshops, or one workshop held once in the north and once in the south of our region. And those two workshops will really establish to the broader community of urban stakeholders what the joint effort is and the kind of direction it's leading to for stormwater requirements on parcel development for post-construction requirements. So on February 15th, we have that broad stakeholder workshop. On March 15th, we have the water board workshop or meeting with a agenda item on the joint effort. Then we'll have another more intensive workshop that focuses more on the actual final requirements that are coming down the pike. And then in July, the water board will actually be presented with the final set of options.
And then at the point that the water board approves something, this permit contemplates that those would then be substituted in as necessary to the Salinas permit.
Correct.
And has Salinas been participating in your advisory group?
There's no one from Salinas on the joint effort review team, and we've only had informal conversations with them independently. They will be attending the workshops that happen in February, and we'll get a full review of it at that time. There's also, you know, we maintain a full paper trail of all the documentation for the project on our website. And I send out occasional reminders that information is available. And on October 31st, I completed a status report, which I think preceded your appointment. But the board received a status report on the joint effort at the end of October, and that was the subject of an EO report item.
Okay. And Salinas is not on the advisory team?
They're not on the joint effort review team. That's correct. And not every municipality is represented. It was a key group of stakeholders.
Yep. Okay. If we have no other questions of staff, then we could...
Oh, we do.
Mr. Delgado, go ahead.
Was Salinas not on that group because it was a group of Phase 2 stakeholders?
No. Salinas, as well as the rest of municipalities, have been part of the process. Everybody signed up to participate in this joint effort, and so they have provided data and been a part of the process. But as far as Dominic put together a small group of people that could help him provide technical assistance, wasn't related to Phase 1 or Phase 2. There was just a small group of people.
Okay. After public comment, would you be willing to address the $85 million cost figure that a lot of us read in the paper, and kind of walk us through that and the staff's response to that after public comment?
Okay, sure.
It's probably going to come up. But the main question I wanted to ask was regarding our supplement, where there's a table of tasks, whether they're existing, modified, or new, that are in this permit. And I counted 67 new tasks that aren't being modified. They don't exist in the new permit at all. And 28 of those 67 new tasks don't have any footnote, which means they were created by our Central Coast Water Board staff. And I think that if I was the city, I would be most concerned about these new tasks that are, especially if they were expensive, and especially if they weren't being implemented by other Phase 2 permittees. And I think that the lack of a footnote indicates that it's very possible that they're not being implemented by other Phase 2 permittees. So the 28 non-footnoted new tasks,
are the most concerning to me. But when I look at them, they include tasks. This is on page, page 3. Top of page 3, staff training and assessment. And it's hard to believe that other phase 2 permittees don't have staff training and assessment requirements in their phase 2 in their phase 1 permit. Sorry, I've been saying phase 2, haven't I? Phase 1 permit.
Yeah, so I guess I can address a few things that you touched on. One of which is kind of counting the number is tough because some of these tasks are a 1 hour task versus another new task might be develop a plan for the Salinas River outfall, which is more than a 1 hour task. So numbers are good, but not necessarily a gauge to how much level of effort. And some of the things that are new that don't have a footnote are things like develop a plan for the Salinas River outfall. That's a specific problem to the city of Salinas. It didn't come from anywhere else. Your question specifically on the training, I believe that's a footnote for the training of the residential requirements. And it might be that it exists. We basically looked, and there's no way to do a complete exhaustive search in every single permit. We tried to provide as many examples and references as where we could, so you're right. We're not breaking new ground there.
Okay. So just because it doesn't have a footnote doesn't mean that central staff created it and it doesn't exist elsewhere.
Correct.
Okay. Another one was that it was to the bottom of page 6 that Salinas participate in the development of a salt and nutrient groundwater plan as per a existing state water board resolution. Mm-hmm. So I would guess that if it's a state board water resolution that is what we're trying to comply with, that probably other phase 1 permittees have something similar, even though there's no footnote.
Yeah, and which one are you looking at? 6?
Second
is this
the IR?
Participate in the salt nutrient management plan.
Yeah,
oh, sorry.
Right.
Dominic said he can take that one.
Yeah, I think what's important there, you're right, it's a state board policy, salt nutrient management policy that exists, and groundwater stakeholders are participating in the development of salt nutrient management plans all over. What's perhaps unique is that the Central Coast Water Board recognized that the stormwater permit was an ideal kind of venue in which to ensure that the city of Salinas is engaged in as a stakeholder in the development of a salt nutrient management plan. We could have left it out and the city would probably be a stakeholder in that process, but we felt like it's a nice way to kind of close the lap or cross our T's and dot our I's, so to speak, just to kind of connect other state board expectations and resolutions with the stormwater permit. It's not it's not a creation of the permit.
So it's possible that no other phase 1 permittees have that in their permit, even though many of them are probably doing it.
Exactly.
I'm pretty sure that the Los Angeles Regional Board MS4 has that requirement.
So then it's just a matter of the staff not having the time in the last few weeks to do an exhaustive search of all these.
Yeah, we did the best we could to point to areas, but the permits are long and they're detailed, and so there's likely some things that we missed, as well as we pointed to one and it exists in 2 others. But we tried to help out as much as we could.
Okay. I think that's it for questions of staff.
Great.
We can